I'm Peggy Clark, and welcome to The Bridge. The Bridge features wise women from different geographies and generations in revelatory conversations about what matters most. The Bridge is a podcast of the Aspen Institute, a values-based forum for the exchange of ideas. So I'm joined today by two really remarkable women who I respect very much and have loved getting to know, Jacqueline Novogratz and Steph Spears. I'm delighted to be with you both. Welcome.
Thanks, Peggy. It's great to be here.
So Jacqueline Novogratz is the founder and CEO of Acumen, which has invested close to $130 million in more than 130 social enterprises across Africa, Latin America, South Asia, and the United States. And they also manage more than close to $150 million in three for-profit impact funds. These enterprises have brought basic services in affordable housing, healthcare, clean water, energy, and sanitation to more than 250 million people. So Jacqueline has been honored with numerous awards, including Forbes' Greatest Living Business Minds and Foreign Policy Magazine's Top 100 Global Thinkers. And Jacqueline is widely recognized as a leading global voice for how we show up and invest in the developing world. And then full disclosure, Jacqueline is a beloved and dear friend who I've known for more than 36 years. We used to work on Wall Street together before we decamped to social purpose work. And I'm so happy to have this conversation with you, Jacqueline, and to have the chance to really dive deeply into your new book.
Thanks, Peggy. I'm so happy to be here with you and with Steph.
Yeah. So let me also join into the conversation, Steph Spears. Steph, you are the co-founder and CEO of Solstice, a social enterprise working to make solar power accessible and affordable for every American. And you previously led innovation initiatives at D-Light India. You spearheaded Acumen's renewable energy sector investment strategy, and you developed Middle East policy as the youngest director of the White House National Security Council. And you also led field operations in seven states for the first Obama presidential campaign, which is fascinating. I wonder what you're thinking about where we are at this moment. You're also an Acumen Global Fellow. So welcome, Steph.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me both.
Great. So in our talk today, we're going to really talk about three different things. One is Jacqueline's book. The other is you two, your own leadership journeys and how you support and know each other. And then lastly, this critical moment that we sort of find ourselves in the world today. So let's jump right in. And let's start with the story of how you first met. So Steph, I understand you left a dream job at the White House, the White House, to be an intern with Acumen with Jacqueline. Is that right?
Yeah, I wasn't so lucky to work with Jacqueline directly every day. I went to Pakistan for my internship. And I am also not the only one who has left a job and tried to build the world that Jacqueline has been talking about building, the world as it should be. Lots of people have quit their jobs to try to join the Acumen mission. But I was a global fellow after my internship in Pakistan, and I was in India. And during the training, Jacqueline spoke to the whole fellow class. And I remember this so vividly. She said that feeling guilty about your privilege is not the point. The point of having privilege is to use it to open up access and opportunities for other people who lack that privilege. And she encapsulated what I think is actually my life mission. And her words have continued to inspire so much about Solstice.
Mm, that's beautifully said. Jacqueline, is that the way you remember meeting Steph? And is it true that over time you have become a mentor-mentee kind of relationship?
I remember being confronted by Steph's ferocity when I first met her. I actually had this great privilege of doing what we learned at Aspen, which is Good Society Readings, although with the global fellows at Acumen, we mix it up with readings from all over the world, including some poetry. And it was very clear that Steph came with this multi-layered sense of her identity, who she was in the world, and that this was a young woman who, like me, wanted to be used up in the world to her best purpose. And so I had one of those immediate falling in love with the spirit of this young, fierce woman who was out to change the world. So I saw it more in terms of my being inspired by Steph.
That's so beautifully said. Steph, did you know that? That's awesome to hear, isn't it?
Yeah, I've never heard that before, and feel very lucky and privileged to be in Jacqueline's orbit.
Beautiful. So let's jump into talking about the book, which is beautiful, Manifesto for a Moral Revolution. And I know, Jacqueline, it's been a real labor of love and an intense book to write, different from your first book, The Blue Sweater. And I'm sure that many people were skeptical when you said you wanted to write a book on moral leadership, you know, especially your investors and others in the business world that you work with. So why did you choose to write a book on moral leadership?
Well, I actually set out, my board said, it's time for you to write a book. You're known as a pioneer in the impact investing field. Why don't you write a book on what that means, how to do it? And when I sat down, I actually did write a 200-page draft of what it takes to build our companies. And I realized that when it came right down to it, too often we talk about the technical shifts that are needed. We talk about all of the operational details that are required to form a company. And that's important. You need those competences. But as you heard Steph say, you know, she and I were born to change systems. We want to change much larger enterprise, much larger things than the enterprise itself. And the single thing that differentiated those individuals that changed entire systems, and I dare say in some cases influenced their nations, and those that built successful companies, comes down to one word: character. And the kind of character that is needed in this age of interdependency, great inequality, the confrontation that we all have with catastrophic climate change, is moral leadership. And the idea that we need entrepreneurs who are seeking to serve others, not just themselves.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting, seeking to serve others. And so that takes me to this place, which is so important, about what do you mean by moral leadership? And so to many, and maybe to me, because Jacqueline, we've known each other for a long time, and you know I'm a lot looser than you, the word moral kind of conjures up this black and white sense of right and wrong, and in some ways almost a religious or a lofty kind of an aspiration. And Steph, you had an interesting perspective on this when we were talking about moral leadership, that you think that Jacqueline was using this word as almost a way to call people to a higher place. What are your thoughts about that term moral leadership?
I think it's a lot like the term impact investment, right? Impact investment is used to describe a kind of investment that is seeking to have positive social or environmental impact in the world. But when you think about it, every investment has an impact. And sometimes that impact is positive and negative. And especially now in our world, our leaders have moral impact. What they do and the example they set is essentially creating frameworks for how what people think is good or bad and how they aspire to act. And so every decision that a leader makes is moral. And so rather than think of morality as compartmentalized in something like religion or how we think about our families, that we have to extend this concept of morality to the greater society and apply it to places and rooms that don't talk about morality, like business.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. And Jacqueline, I understand this book has kind of become a lightning rod for very strong feelings across the spectrum of perspectives. And so much so that the way that Steph, for example, is describing morality, a lot of the people from the investment community, the business community, look at this book and say, it's just soft, it's too soft and squishy and fluffy. And then others from the other side will say, you know, in this contextual moment we're living in, what authority do you have as a white woman to be speaking to moral leadership for the developing world? So tell us a little bit about how this book is being received and where, what is happening and how you're perceiving their reactions to it.
Yeah, well, first, I definitely don't want the book to be seen as speaking for moral leadership for the developing world. In fact, some of the most extraordinary moral leaders that I have learned from and been inspired by, not only come from the developing world, but come from some of the most marginalized communities in the developing world. I think that what Seth said is just so powerful, Peggy. In fact, I wish that I had Steph by my side as the, you know, agent that was introducing all of this, that we have gotten to such a point in society where it looks like those who win feel they can only win by ensuring that others lose, that too many of our leaders are defining their own success based only on terms of how wealthy they are, money, fame, power. And so we do need a modifier. Investing can't just be for shareholders. Impact investing was a way of saying there is a responsibility that comes with the privilege of investing. So is there a responsibility that comes with the privilege of leading. And it is not for a small tribe, nor even a single religion or nation. It is in an interdependent world that is showing itself as increasingly fragile. It is to lead from a place of our individual and shared humanity, our dignity. And so we're all trying to figure out what that means. But right now, I think there's so much fear that it's pushing us into separate corners. So as you said, there are those that say, you know, you're using markets to try to solve problems of poverty. Haven't you seen what capitalism has done, the ravages to the poor, to the environment? And yes, there's great truth on that side. The ravages and the extremes of capitalism do exclude and sometimes exploit. And on the other side, there are those who are pure capitalists that say, are you kidding me? Look at the authoritarian societies that choose for people and exclude and exploit the poor, create great dependency, and only allow a few people to be the preferred party dignitaries. And it's true. And so rather than get stuck between this system or that system, what interests me and why I'm so excited about that the next generation of leaders like Steph is that the real conversation lies underneath. It was, what are the values with which we will walk in the world, whether we are building businesses or organizations or government agencies? We are here to solve the toughest problems of our time. And more than any time in history, we have the tools and the technologies. Capital is an important tool. But if we see money as the end in and of itself, we get where we're going. We have to think of these as tools that we use in purpose of something greater than ourselves.
That's really beautifully said. Steph, tell me what you think about this way that Jacqueline is using the term morality. And in particular, you said we have to recognize that people have different moral compasses. But if, for example, the moral compass in the technology sector, you've talked a little bit about. So tell us your thoughts.
Jacqueline just spoke so eloquently about the imperative for leaders to step up and try to solve the biggest problems of our time. And yet sometimes it feels like the startup world or the tech world is channeling all of these incredible resources and data and time into solving problems of convenience, you know, and how do we get pizzas faster? How do we get rides faster? And all of that stuff is good because people demand it, but we also are not addressing the biggest problems of our time. And to be more precise, I think it's the collective action problems. The collective action problems are the problems in which the best interests of the group are not always served by the best interests of the individual. And so it requires us, if we're thinking about how to solve big collective action problems like inequality or climate change, that individual leaders have to choose to do what is good for the big group, because if those leaders don't do it, then no one else will. So we need to spend more of our tech and innovation and talent solving these intractable collective action problems rather than problems of convenience.
And the reason we need moral, Peggy, is we don't have an easy roadmap. This is actually a lonely road in this moment of history, because the systems that have developed reward those individuals that are focusing on the individual rather than the collective. And so the moral leader is the leader that dares to do the right thing, not the easy thing. And that often brings with it a sense of isolation. And so knowing that you're doing it on behalf of the collective, on behalf of a larger group, I think is a way of finding a strength that what is morality if not that the equal imperative of learning to put ourselves in another's shoes while also having the humility of understanding that we can never wear fully another's shoes. But it's only when we're able to think of ourselves as the people who've been excluded and trying to rebuild and reimagine systems so that they can be included, that we start to find a collective moral compass.
So beautifully said. But I would imagine you get a lot of pushback to this notion of moral leadership. I mean, we all know that true leaders in whatever sector have this element of remarkable character. But as you've talked about your book, Jacqueline, and as you, Steph, are trying to argue for that kind of common good approach to renewable energy, don't you get a lot of people that tell you there's a pushback if you're trying to do the right thing and also do the expedient thing from a business perspective?
I think there's the element here under debate is really about what time period are we looking at? Are we looking at what's good for quarterly returns? Are we looking at what is good for our children and our grandchildren? And those sometimes are the same thing, and sometimes they are at conflict, and we have to be really honest about some of the trade-offs there. And, you know, F. Scott Fitzgerald said that the mark of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposing ideas in mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. And I actually think Jacqueline gets a bad rap for being an idealist because she's so inspiring, but she's actually incredibly practical. And what she's describing is a world in which you're taking the best of the tools, the best of capitalism, the best of philanthropy, and trying to co-create solutions that address some of these problems.
I love that Fitzgerald quote. I think that's what we all need to be carrying around every day, holding these opposing opposites. So let's move into, there are such beautiful parts in this book, Jacqueline, about reaching across to the other. And I know, Steph, this is such a big part of your life and in your life's work. And so there's one part in the book where you say, our shared humanity is strong and vast enough to encompass our beautiful diversity. Think of yourself as a bridge extending forward so that others may walk across. So I want to ask both of you, and Jacqueline, how are you being a bridge right now? And what does it feel like, especially in this moment? And Steph, I also want to hear from you on that.
Probably on multiple levels, Peggy. The older I get, the more keenly aware of the privilege that I have. One is acting as a bridge to convene, and in some ways as the outsider. One of the great joys of building Acumen Academy, which is our university for social change for anyone, anywhere, essentially, is that I get to sit with groups of fellows across race, class, ethnicity, tribe, caste. And this past summer, I got to spend 3-4 hours a day, essentially, you know, virtually in Bangladesh, Pakistan, and India for a week at a time. And to just create that bridge, create the platform without judgment, but also holding people accountable to listen to each other and to speak from a place of principle, not just flinging opinion at one another, is a way of holding a bridge. And the second, and I really appreciate Steph saying, you know, Jacqueline gets seen as an idealist sometimes, you know, moral leadership is not the path of purity either. That if you are actually going to build something, particularly in this moment of so many competing belief systems, where we operate in cultures that prize the collective over the individual, who have to engage in business with other communities that have taken individualism to an extreme, you have to find a way to communicate in ways that both sides can hear. We have companies that are trying to turn capitalism on its head, looking at chocolate and coffee paying the farmers a fair living, sustainable wage, essentially, to sell to wealthier markets. That's not been done since, you know, in 500 years. And so finding ways to bridge large corporate interests, smallholder farmers, social entrepreneurs in the middle is a second way. And the third goes to your point of people that are uncomfortable on one side with anything having to do with markets, and on the other side, with seeing that those who are uncomfortable are idealistic and fuzzy-headed, that the truth lies somewhere in the middle. One of my favorite poems is by the Sufi poet Rumi, who says, out beyond right doing and wrongdoing is a field. I'll meet you there. That we have to do what F. Scott Fitzgerald said 1,000 years later, which is dare to hold competing beliefs and, I dare say, values without rejecting either.
That's really beautifully said. And Steph, I know that, you know, you both are bridge builders. You both walk this line between different worlds. And Steph, I think you said your job is more and more to be a cultural translator, that it's not preaching to the choir. But what do you mean by that? And how are you a bridge in your work?
Yeah, I come from the world of politics and activism, and that is the world I'm probably feel a little more comfortable in, because I feel like those folks share my values of trying to organize a world that is more just and equitable. But I run a solar company. Our solar company serves also the developers and the financiers who build solar projects. And it is my job to live between the activist world that is trying to make clean energy more equitable and try to convince developers and financiers who are building these projects that it is in their interest to care more about justice and equity too. And so on a good day, I'll probably not satisfy either side, because I'm not fully on anti-capitalist enough sometimes for the social justice area. And then I'm not profit-driven enough for the market folks, right? And so there is a comfort that you have to be with being dissatisfactory to everyone around you if you're trying to create a third way. And the third way that Jacqueline's describing is a world in which these two sides talk to each other. Right now, in my world, the developers don't talk to the environmental justice community. The environmental justice community just doesn't care about whether the developers make profits on their projects, because those profits are coming at the expense of people. And so how do you get these two sides to talk to each other? It comes down to individual commonality and bridge building that you're talking about, Peggy. It comes down, there's a sociologist, his name is Robert Cushing, and he talks about how back in mid-20th century America, people were moving to new towns and new neighborhoods because those were better neighborhoods, those were better towns, and they were moving up in life. Now the trend is that people move to be close to other people who think like them. And so we're getting increasingly polarized and increasingly siloed, and where we are as a country right now is a result of that. And who's going to change that but leaders that are trying to build bridges between these two extremes? That's the only path I see out of this way forward.
Steph gave me a beautiful phrase a couple of summers ago where she talked about how important it is for us as leaders to have sanctuaries where you are with people who understand the discomfort of being on that bridge by yourself often. And also she talks about the importance of going outside your sanctuary and really trying to speak to those who are different from us. And that's the language that I would use would be the moral imagination that really can start that conversation, that you actually enter it from a space of inquiry, not from your own certainty. And I think that is a place that Steph and I really, really deeply feel like sisters, that there is a need to bring together private sector capital, civil society, and government for most of our most intractable problems, or we will not solve them. And if we stand there with a sense of purity and righteousness, that our side knows the way, well, then we will be standing small, brittle, and broken when all is said and done, rather than finding our common humanity in a way that we can truly find opportunities for people to flourish.
I'm Peggy Clark, and you're listening to The Bridge, a podcast of the Aspen Institute. If you liked today's episode, you can listen to other great episodes from season 3, such as a talk with Madeleine Albright and her daughter Alice Albright, a talk with supermajority founders Cecile Richards and Ai-Jen Po and Catherine Granger, and many, many more. Just search The Bridge from the Aspen Institute on your favorite podcast app. And now back to The Bridge.
You guys have both talked about how really showing up in this way and walking on this bridge and being in this uncomfortable space requires a really honest self-reckoning, and how difficult and complex that is. And I think this is happening to so many people right now in this cracking open moment with the rise of Black Lives Matter after the killing of George Floyd, and this powerful reckoning with who we are and what our motivations are and how we show up when we're working with the poor. So to what extent do you have conversations with yourself about whether we are playing out some kind of a script about the great white savior, or how can we authentically really show up in places where perhaps people are finding voice to say things they hadn't said before? And how do you both keep looking anew at your own honest way that you're showing up on that bridge in interacting with the other?
The moment we're in is largely a reckoning that our actions have consequences. It's the same reckoning that applies to racism, to climate change, to public health. Our actions and how we treat each other, we think don't affect other people. It does affect other people. And we ultimately can play into a world in which we're trying to recreate the systems that have allowed for unequal class systems in which people, through no fault of their own, do not have the resources that they need to aspire to live thriving lives. And you mentioned kind of the great white savior. I'm not white, but I will say that I'm pretty sure what people want, and what Jacqueline talks a lot about, is just people want dignity. You know, people don't want handouts, they want a ladder. And so what our job is in this moment is to create the opportunities so that other people can take that ladder up, rather than try to live out some entire narrative of saving and liberation.
What do you think, Jacqueline, about the reckoning moment?
One of the great joys of building a diverse community, especially with the younger generation, where there is trust that you're all there for the right reason, where you have, you know, we do a lot of constant reckoning in the way that we try to show up with each other, is that people will tell you the truth and not just throw you out for saying the wrong thing, which is a risk that we have in this moment of righteousness. And so there are times when I don't show up in the way that I want. I think of a time meeting one of our fellows in India from the lowest caste, of the Dalits, the scavengers, a group of people consigned for many generations to pick up human waste. And here I thought that I was really culturally attuned, waiting on a very hot day in a coffee shop. And when Vimal was 10, 15 minutes late, I knew that culturally that didn't make sense. Either the bus had broken down, or maybe he wasn't comfortable going in the restaurant. And so I went outside, and sure enough, there he was. And we went inside, and I asked him if he wanted a coffee, croissant, what have you, and all he wanted was water. And I was so eager to have the conversation with him, and we did. And it was an amazing conversation. And it really took a year before we were talking about the first time that we had ever met each other. And I said, you know, were you uncomfortable to go into the place? And he said, yeah, you know, I didn't have any money. And I was so nervous that if I went in and they asked me if I wanted to buy anything, and I didn't have any money, maybe they would ask me to leave, right? We forget how we take for granted, if we're privileged, that we're allowed to go into these places. But then he said, and you know, I was so hungry. And I said, Vimal, you didn't want any food that day. And he said, well, I was just worried that maybe you would ask me to share the bill. And I felt so ashamed, because here's this young man that I just adore. And we had such an amazing conversation. And I was so eager in my desire to know him and to meet his emotional hunger to be heard, that I missed his physical hunger that was also present. And so the gift of knowing Vimal and building that trust is that he was able to tell me the truth without just deciding that I was thoughtless and careless, even though in that moment I was pretty thoughtless and careless. And so I think it's there are many reasons diverse communities are powerful. There's an imperative in it if we are going to solve our complex problems, because our world has become so interdependent. But one of the reasons is we get a chance to look more deeply into our own humanity and get better.
That's beautifully said. So let's talk a little bit about idealism. And Jacqueline, I have the fortune of knowing you in your 20s when you first went off to Africa. And, you know, it's this very idealistic, hopeful, off to change the world. And Steph, I'm sure that you could tell us the same story about you when you started doing this work. And, you know, I can see that. And I remember some of your first stories and some of your first encounters with these powerful African women. And this was before living through the Rwandan genocide, before living through a lot of the challenges that you've lived through. So I want to reflect a little bit on that. But what would you, if you could roll back the clock, what would you say to that young 24-year-old right now who was on the plane heading off to Africa to do microfinance work?
I would say go. I would say go and try. Listen before you come with answers. I think that was one of the big mistakes that I made as a 24-year-old, 25-year-old, was that I had so much to offer, you know, to make change, that I didn't really start by listening deeply enough with a true humility at the beginning. But don't lose that sense that you can actually succeed, that you can actually do the impossible, because I think that is one of the great powers of being young. The idea that I went to Rwanda at age 25 to start the first microfinance bank with a small group of Rwandan people when women had just gotten the right to open a bank account. And the average income was $112. And I had all of 3 years per year, $112 per year. And I had all of 3 years of banking experience is insanity. But the truth is, nobody else was trying. And the same lesson came to me in 2001 when 9/11 happened. And everybody was running away from the Middle East. And I thought, the only way we will understand the Muslim world as Americans who are living in a moment of such fear is to move into it. And then I got cold feet and said, am I really going to go to Pakistan? It's a place I've never been. I don't understand at all. We only have 3 people on the team. And a really wise person said to me, if you have the courage to go and you have the determination to do work and stay for 10 years, I promise you, by the end of 10 years, you're going to know more than just about any other outsider. And he was right. Mm-hmm. And so I would say, go, commit, don't quit, Let the work teach you.
Steph, any thoughts on idealism and your idealistic self?
I used to think that all problems could be solved with just a little more political will. And now that I'm a little older, I realize it takes a little bit more than that. And it's not just an individual's will. When I was working in Acumen, I was working in some of the most off-grid communities in India, and you had to take a plane, then an overnight train, then a car to get to these villages, and you see why people don't have access to electricity. And it's about systems. Systems are incentivized to not give them access to electricity. And so if we have any hope of changing that outcome, then we have to change the system in addition to having the political will to change.
That's great. But are you still idealistic, Steph?
I am. But I have to say, we call it the solar coaster in my industry because there's high highs and low lows, but I have to say that I remain a delusional optimist. I think it's what's gotten us through this far. And so I would tell my younger self, there will be moments that you will want to quit because it is so hard. And I know you're not the type of person who quits, but just keep going, because once you get through that hard moment and meet other people on the other side who believe in the same things you do, then together with other people, you can actually do impossible things. And that's what the Obama campaign taught me. Acumen taught me that. And now Solstice is teaching me that.
I love that, Steph. And Peggy, the other piece that you learn, because when you go off to quote unquote save the world with all that idealism, particularly when you're working with low-income people in sectors like off-grid energy, like Steph has been doing for a long time, or water or healthcare. These are the most corrupt, broken industries on the planet. And so not only do you have to hold that sense of fierce, pragmatic aspiration, but you have to know with whom you are contending. And you have to be not only stubborn, but sometimes proactive in ways that we never talk about. But, you know, sometimes you have to play hardball. And that is a part of change that brings in the hard-edged hope that I think Steph and I both live with. But it is in the name of a world of more dignity. And it's that, you talk about holding tensions. Right. It is that tension of idealism and that tension of fierce pragmatism that combined allows for the hard-edged hope, even when a lot of people feel despair.
That's really true. And it's so funny that this point, Declan, because I think of you as really doing both of those things, idealism as pragmatism. And I think about you when we worked at the bank, you helping me with my cash flow analysis, and you are incredibly pragmatic. So I know that you've talked about this book and you speak to business school students about building businesses and others about character and morality. So you really are walking this line, but you both are walking this line in the moment when there's this extreme energetic activism happening. So I just want to reflect on this for a moment. And just to be kind of straight with you both are held up as these remarkable new types of women leaders. And so what do you think about where the women's rights or women's justice or women's leadership movement is right now, or more broadly, the movement of women's rights and justice, and in the fact that you're often held up as ones that are pushing that boundary. Do you feel we're moving in the right direction? Do you feel like we're in a time of chaos? Do you feel like we're redressing things that have been long ignored? I want to maybe start with you, Declan, because you really are often celebrated as a person that many of us should follow as a leader at this moment of activism. Where's the movement right now? Is it okay?
I mean, we are in a moment of breaking opening. We're in a moment of awakening, and in that, to me, is great hope. It is not a time to be complacent about that awakening. It is a time to double down and to have the really honest conversations. You know, you're getting me on a day, Peggy, after I've just spent time with a lot of young women. And one of their struggles is around what it means to be women, in particularly in cultures where women are still consigned to second-class citizen status. Rousseau says that man is born free, yet everywhere he is in chains. And we were talking about this idea. And one of the young women said, you know, even if you got rid of all the men, we would still hold ourselves back, because it's the mothers and the mothers-in-laws that reinforce what we have been taught to be for many, many generations. And so we are fighting on all sides. And there was such a sense of vulnerability and strength. I know these women, they code switch like nobody's business. They will be out in the streets fighting for justice, and they will go home and get on their knees as they serve their father-in-law with a veil. And so for me, what is so tender about this moment is that we are judging each other in quite extraordinary ways. And what's needed is for us to create more spaces where we can speak with that kind of vulnerability about the world that we want and the world, the mess that we're in. What gives me great hope, and you keep saying we've known each other for 36 years, in those 36 years is that I have seen my generation hold ourselves back in ways that Steph's generation does not. And there is great reason for belief here, but we cannot sit back and watch the political waves start to blame women for the fears that we have. We have to be fighting that. We have to stand for that. And we have to make space for those that are hearing these noises and are internalizing what has been many, many generations, frankly, of internalized trauma.
Exactly. What are your thoughts, Steph?
I think it's we should honor Justice Ginsburg, the great Justice Ginsburg, who said that, when will there be enough women on the Supreme Court? When there are nine. And I love that it's a call to continuous improvement. Yeah, we've made a lot of progress as women. Yes, the women's movement has come a long way, but it has still so far to go. We have 22% of the energy industry is women. The whole workforce, 22%. And in renewable energy, you'd think it'd be better, but it's 25% women. And you look at who's in the executive seats, fewer. And you look at who's BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, people of color, fewer. And so right now, I think actually we live in a world where everyone's okay with tokenism. You know, people...
Not everyone.
Yeah. fair. That we accept that as racial progress, you know, that Beyonce and Jay-Z and Barack Obama exist. And there's an incredible a story where Juno Diaz, the author, was speaking at the Strand bookstore in New York. And he was asked, how does it feel to be such an accomplished Dominican-American author? And he said, when I think about my success, I don't think about how great I am. I think about the fact that I am representative of structural exclusion. There are people who are as talented, and because they come from similar backgrounds like me, they don't get the shot. And I feel very similarly, where I sometimes will get investment because people really get genuinely excited to invest in a woman of color who also identifies as queer. So you get the triple threat for the investors, and they love that. But that's, you know, I look and I see comparatively there are so many Black and brown founders who don't have the opportunities that I've been able to get. So we will not stop until not only the women's movement moves forward, but that every single marginalized community gets a shot too. It's not going to be good enough until we get there.
There was a moment on our management committee where I was looking around and I realized that we were all women. And I said, oh my goodness, guys, like we're all women. Like we need to really be focused on diversifying this management committee. And Yasmina Zaidman, who you both know on my team, said, Jacqueline, for 500 years, men have sat around tables that looked and nobody ever asked the question, at least give us 5 minutes.
No, exactly. So let's turn back to Jacqueline's book. And Jacqueline, I wonder if you would grace us with just reading a part that I love so much. And I also need to say, I remember taking a walk with you when you were first beginning thinking about this book. And you told me this story about this moment with this woman in India, and how it exemplified so much of what you wanted to talk about in your book. And so just, it's on page 198 and in the book, and you were on a visit to Self-Employed Women's Association, SEWA, which is this wonderful organization, and you were going to visit a woman in her home. So would you share with us a little bit of that beautiful part of the book?
Yeah, it was a freezing cold day in January, Delhi, and I was shivering the whole day, and I was visiting an extraordinarily low-income family that had literally lived for 7 years in a field, in a tent, with 10 family members, no electricity. And and so that's the background. After 3 hours of conversation. That day, Dampani noticed that I'd not stopped shivering from the freezing air since we'd arrived. She offered us hot tea and biscuits. We declined, knowing the family would have to cross the street to buy water and milk for the tea, but Dampati would not accept my refusal. If I visit you, you will give me tea. Now you are visiting my home. I will do the same. I accepted the milky sweet tea gratefully, delighting in the shot of sugar and heat. Dampati instantly offered me a second cup. My desire to take it was slowed only by my sense of shame. By now, the entire family had joined our conversation and was waiting patiently for us to be sated before they served themselves. The irony of Dampati's attentiveness and her focus on service, her accompaniment, was not lost on me. Who was the real giver here? In that tiny teacup was an ocean of grace, provoking me to examine how often I failed to pause and notice the needs of those right in front of me. I had much to learn from Dampati, and from the way Sewa Gririn accompanied her so that she could accompany others. This is the secret of accompaniment. I will hold a mirror to you and show you your value, bear witness to your suffering and to your light. And over time, you will do the same for me. For within the relationship lies the promise of our shared dignity and the mutual encouragement needed to do the hard things. Whatever you aim to do, whatever problem you hope to address, remember to accompany those who are struggling, who are left out, who lack the capabilities needed to solve their own problems. We are each other's destiny. Beneath the hard skills and firm strategic priorities needed to resolve our greatest challenges lies the soft, fertile ground of our shared humanity. In that place of hard and soft is sustenance enough to nourish the entire human family.
Beautiful. We're coming to the end of our conversation, and I just really want to say I've loved talking with you both. It's just been fantastic, and thank you for who you are and all that you're doing. So we end every Bridge podcast with a bit of a reflection, and it's about hope, and we ask each of you to say one thing you've learned from the other person's generation and one hope you have for their generation. So Jacqueline, let me start with you. What is one thing you've learned from Steph's generation and one hope you have for her generation?
I mean, Steph makes manifest the best of her generation. And what I learn and continually learn was embodied today. And Steph, I just thank you for how every time I get to interact with you, I'm enlivened and enriched and I learn so much. There is a clarity and a fearlessness in you and so many of your generation of the way things could be and should be. And, you know, it inspires me in ways that you don't even know. My hope, because I also am meeting so many young people, people of your generation, that really do feel the world is on fire and are feeling a sense of hopelessness. And to that generation, which I know is not you, I would say that after 35 years of doing this work, change is possible. We talked about Rwanda, and I saw a country that lost everything, renew itself, become a phoenix out of the ashes. And the thing we don't talk about enough is that in doing the hard work of change, and it is hard and gritty, there's beauty to be found. Beauty at every step along the way, if you look for it and if you allow it. Because ultimately, by paying attention to the beauty, even in the practice of showing up and of being kind when you feel like being anything but kind, you end up finding the beauty in yourself.
Beautifully said. So Steph, what's one thing you've learned from Jacqueline's generation and one hope for her?
Jacqueline's passage reminded me of walking through South Africa, actually, and seeing that so many affluent folks of a previous generation just had large walls built up of security because of the poverty and inequality in South Africa. Rich folks have to have castles for homes. And I remember, and her passage made me think that, you know, what if instead of spending a lot of money for security, we spent more money trying to make society more equal? And to hearken back to the South Africa example, Nelson Mandela is the one that said, "It always seems impossible until it is done." And what I learned from Jacqueline is that you can do impossible things that no one else thinks you can. I mean, she, at the top of this hour, you described all the investment that almost equals to $300 million that Jacqueline and her team at Acumen has been able to fund businesses that I can tell you would not have found funding otherwise, and been able to incubate incredible ideas that have gone on to germinate new enterprises. And so what I learned from Jacqueline in her generation in the best way is that you can do impossible things if you just are that gritty enough, like Jacqueline has been. My hope for other parts of her generation, and I speak from an assumption that her generation has more power and more resources than my generation. My hope is that that generation asks themselves the question, when is power a renewable resource and when is it a finite resource? And in cases and in certain institutions where it is a finite resource, can I give away some of that power? Can I share some of that power? And can I cede some of that finite power to break the walls down of my mansion and create a more just and equitable society? And does giving away my power have to hurt me, or can it help everyone? That's my hope for that generation.
Beautiful. So I am so honored to have had you both here today. Thank you so much for this great conversation. And I'm Peggy Clark, and thanks to all of you for joining us on The Bridge today, a production of the Aspen Institute. So don't forget to download the podcast on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Just search The Bridge from the Aspen Institute. Thanks so much, everyone. Bye now.